Folks, thanks very much. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. Sobriety Day's Groundhog Day of 57. And that sounds like a long time, because it is, by golly. Suffered every minute of it. I just think about it's confusing to folks sometimes, but the 19th of last month marked the 49th year since my last drink. And I don't celebrate that. I think there's a big difference between not drinking and recovery. So I don't celebrate that. That was really credit to the sheriff, because he locked me up that day. But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous February 2nd of 57. I could and would love to spend the whole time just greeting my friends from all around. It's really, really super that at least half of the people who stood up from various states are good friends of mine. And what a nice, nice feeling to be with good buddies from all over the place. I hope those of you who are less than 30 days sober, I hope you can connect with what I'm just going to say, that one of the truly warm and wonderful and rewarding things in Alcoholics Anonymous is that darkness that prevails in those early days of sobriety do indeed lighten up. And instead of feeling like you're alone on the face of this earth, there comes a time when you genuinely not only feel connected, but are connected to people all over this place. And all we have to do is just give into this thing, get into the throes of this fellowship, and let it happen. Man, it's a marvelous thing. I'm delighted to be here and getting ready for... I'm a little uneasy about what we got coming up this weekend. I know in the book it says that someplace in there that we don't have to be afraid of anything. We can go to the most sordid places in the world and we'll be okay. But I swear to God, it just doesn't sound very spiritual to be going to Whiskey Pete's for the weekend. I'm sure it's okay and we'll make it through there, but that's going to test us severely. The other thing I just want to share, my wife is here somewhere. She's true to form. She's on the very back row. Yes, she is. Right on, I mean, on behind the back, right there. That girl. A lot of y'all have heard me talk about her. Got her loaded up this time, and we've got a pretty nice room downtown, and we came in a couple of days early because she doesn't sin on a regular basis. She kind of gets evil. And so I like to get her to Sin City and let her just turn loose a little bit once in a while. And so we're sitting there today looking out the window at this beautiful road, way to look out over the town. And I said, you know, this is something. A little old girl from a wheat farm in Saskatchewan and a good old boy from a cotton mill culture in North Carolina. And here we are sitting way up high in Sin City, USA. Man, we ain't doing bad at all. And that's the truth. That is really, really something else. And so I kind of want to tell you about how that came about. I'm going to have to go fast. Got a timekeeper. He told me I had 2 minutes to go before I started. So I'm going to quit my drinking and get into talking about drinking. I want to just sort of share with you, and I'll have to do it in a rush and hurry. By the way, I hated to break up a really good meeting with a speaker. Y'all were just having a good time with what you were doing, and that's kind of a downer, just come in here and start talking about drinking, throwing up 101 and all that stuff. But that's what I'm going to do. I'm a guy, just a fairly typical kind of a dude, I guess. I was a lot like Calvin. I used to be big and black. And I don't know what happened. I knew malnutrition set in or something. But I was a lot like him in the ways that matter on the inside. And like most of us that I've ever met here, we're folks that just sort of have a little uncomfortable time with this thing called life. And I was one of those. Yeah, I think we come in two basic varieties, us alcoholics. One is the slow bloomer and one is the real quick study. You know, the slow bloomer just drinks a long time and then he finally wears out or something and gives up the ghost. Some of us are just naturals. I mean, we're basket cases from day one, and that was me. I found booze. I found a marvelous solution to every problem I ever imagined. And that's what alcohol constituted for me, was a real solution. And I'll tell you something, it never did quit being a solution. I think the saddest thing I've ever heard an alcoholic say is it quit working for me. Mine never quit working for me. I never went to booze a single time that I didn't get exactly what I was looking for. Unfortunately, there came a time when I started getting a lot more than I was looking for. I not only got the solution, but the solution became the problem. And so booze was a tremendously important thing for me. I loved it. I loved how it made me feel. I loved how it made me act. I loved everything about it. Loved the folks I hung around with. Loved the trashy behavior. Loved most of it. Never got real fond of dry heaves or going to jail. But other than that, I mean, I loved everything about booze. And I'll tell you something, I would be doing it right now. Here in the, you know, this has got to be the spiritual epicenter of anonymity. What happens here stays here. Is that anonymity or what? And I would be doing it. Yeah, you know, when I get into a city like this, I feel the old vibes coming. I feel the tempo step up a little bit. And it would just be a natural for me. But there's one reason that I'm not doing that, and that is that I developed alcoholism. I'm not going into a whole bunch of dissertation on anything, and certainly not alcoholism, because I don't know a lot about it. I've heard a lot about it, read a lot of books, seen a lot of movies, listened to a lot of tapes, listened to a lot of experts that gave me headaches. But I'm telling you, after all these years, I think I probably know less about it than I've ever known. But I do know one enormously important thing about alcoholism. I have it. Don't know why. It doesn't matter why. Really isn't all that important. Etiology of alcoholism is kind of a fascinating study. It's pointless, though, because it doesn't really matter. You know, what does matter is that somewhere, best I can tell in my 18th year, I did what we call crossing a line. Doesn't say that in the book anywhere, but that's what we say, crossing a line. And that's what happened to me. I didn't notice at the time. I was up in Brad's country. And being in Alaska will make you lose your hair. I noticed that. It'll also make you lose your mind. I was stationed up there in the military, and that is where I developed alcoholism. Now, they weren't nice enough to put me in Wakulla, where Brad's from. I was in the Aleutian Islands. And there's no human got any business on the Aleutian Islands unless he's a raving maniac. I mean, that's the only thing got any business up there. And they put me, a nice, young, gentle flower of the South, and they stuck me out on that rock in the Bering Sea. And I did my best to drink my way into oblivion every moment of the day. And somewhere in the middle of that madness, I crossed that line. Now, I didn't notice it because I was quite drunk when it happened. Was not noticing subtleties, but something happened, and we refer to it as crossing the line. The best definition that I've ever heard of alcoholism from all the hundreds I've heard is a simple little thing on that first page of the third chapter, more about alcoholism, where it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. That's exactly who I am. I'm a man who lost the ability to control my drinking. That's probably the most fundamentally important thing I'll say tonight, and I hope I hear it, because that is my problem. My problem is not what happened to me circumstantially as a result of my drinking. I'm not alcoholic because I went to jail a lot. I went to jail a lot because I was alcoholic, just the converse. I'm not alcoholic because I got my nose broke, lost my car, woke up married one time, for God's sakes, to a woman I didn't even know. Now, I tell you, buddy, that's bad liquor when you do something like that. Won't make you stop drinking, though. That's not a product. That doesn't produce alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic because I lost the ability to control my drinking. Don't know why. I really don't care why. But what I do know is this. If I take a drink of anything with alcohol in it, something happens to me that doesn't happen to 9 out of 10 human beings. I cannot predict how much I'll drink, how long I'll drink, where I'll drink, what I'll do when I drink. Nothing. It's just an absolute adventure, and that's exactly what happened when I was 18. My life just sort of took off like Topsy, And it happened in such a hurry that I was past the point almost of no return before I even knew I was in trouble. I was thrown out of the military when I was 20 years old, for God's sake, just barely shaved. And I'm thrown out as being unfit for military service back. And most people in the military back then were leftovers from the Second World War. They were a rough crowd. And they'd get some potential rocket scientist like me, throw me out as being unfit for alcoholism, 20 years old. Of course, you know how much impact that had on me. But my life just sort of went downhill in a rushing hurry. It sounds unbelievable in some ways when I think about the devastation in my life, but my serious drinking lasted a grand total of 8 years. And in the course of that, destroyed my life and unfortunately devastated some others in the process. And so mine was a very quick and episodic kind of a thing. And I was deteriorating, crashing ahead so quickly that I didn't even really notice what was happening. It's a strange thing, and I wish I could talk about it a little bit. Maybe we'll down at Whiskey Pete's. But it's a strange thing, but in the book, we never talk about denial. Because I think denial is too lightweight for what happens in alcoholism. What we talk about in the book are two things, delusion and illusion. Delusion is an inability to separate the true from the false, the way the book describes it. Now, we see something and we don't see it as it is. And an illusion is believing things that don't exist. And that was the story of my life. When I was caught up in the worst era of my drinking, it looked normal to me. Yeah, I'd see people going to work with a lunch bucket, and they looked weird. Yeah, I looked a little weird sometimes. I remember one time when I was still working, before I gave up on that, going to work one time. If you get drunk early enough, you get sober at weird hours. And so I was still trying to salvage a job. I leaped up, grabbed a lunch bucket somebody packed for me, and I ran up to the bus stop. Didn't have a driver's license. Unusual. And I'm waiting for the bus, and some of my drinking buddies came by. Where are you going, man? I said, I'm going to work. God knows I got to get there today. They said, it's 6 o'clock. I said, I know that. They said, it's 6 o'clock in the evening. You know, I'd already gotten drunk one time, sobered up, and I'm ready to go to work. So I just got drunk again. Didn't go to work the next day. But anyway, that was me. I was just sort of that kind of wild, crazy guy. And even though my life became something totally bizarre to observe, to me it seemed normal. I never believed I would ever get into the condition I did, but by the time I got there, I was so caught up in that illusion and delusion and pretense of what my life was and all of the kind of rationalizing that I couldn't even see what was happening. I reached a point in life I was darn near unemployable. And unemployed most of the time. I'd survive by hustling and scuffling and taking advantage of folks who made the mistake of getting too close to me. And I'm not proud of anything I did. I'm not proud of using folks and hustling and conning and taking advantage of people. I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of rolling other drunks. But the society I lived in, you were either the rollee or the roller. Because in that place, somebody gonna get rolled every day, and it's just a matter of whose day was up. And so I'm not proud of that, not by any stretch of the imagination. I was not a gangster or anything like that. I was just one of those social derelicts that was wandering around surviving by whatever it took to survive. Never thought I'd ever sell my blood $5 a throw. But that's what I did. That's what the folks that I hung with did. That's what I did. And I'm confident I'd have let them pump me dry if they hadn't had safeguards against people like me. So I gave them all that take. And so, I mean, it was just that kind of a wipeout. And it'd be real nice to tell you that I got a lot of friends in this room, many, many people here. I don't ever have to worry about just falling out at the podium because about every group I talk to, at least half the group could finish the story. Flanagan could. I know good and well Flanagan could. He's got a good memory. Well, to have drunk as much wine as he drank, he's got a fairly decent memory. So a lot of people could finish it for me. So it would be nice if I could say that I had enough and look for help, but it just didn't happen that way. I wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room has feared doing. Probably family members have feared even greater doing the kind of thing I did. But it's just one of those things that happens in alcoholism all too often, But my God, how many folks like us dodge the bullet? And so what for most people is a bad dream, in my case and many others, it became a real nightmare. And what I'm talking about, I came to one morning in jail, assumed I was in there for the same as always. And I was at a point where when I woke up in jail, I was fairly relaxed about it because it was my most frequent address. And I never had anybody put me there by mistake, at least that admitted it. And so when I came to in there, I assumed it was for the same as always, just street behavior. And when I wake a little while, the jailer came by. I knew him well. And I said, when can I get out? And he said, I hope never. And kept walking. And I knew, I had no clue what he was talking about, but I knew he was not kidding. And then some of the other guys in the drunk tank there told me that the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car blind drunk, blacked out, down the main street of that city, and run down and killed two people. And even though I was a social wrecking ball, I was not a subhuman. I was not a cretin. I was not somebody that was insensitive to human life. And when I was greeted with that information, I guess it was just a defensive thing that I could not accept the information. I could believe it. My God, I knew I was capable of anything. But I just couldn't handle the information. And then just pretended it was not true for a little while, and then gradually the truth came in. I had done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. I'd committed a crime for which there's no suitable punishment. There is none. And so what I did, I just was in such a deep pit of despair and guilt that all I wanted to do was disappear. The first time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. Didn't want out. I was afraid to get out. I was ashamed to get out. I was ashamed to be breathing when two fine young folks no longer were because of me. And so I had absolutely no thoughts of getting out, no more angles and no more curves to shoot. And then for some reason, the policeman there took it on himself. I don't know why. I never knew who he was, but a fellow called my family down in North Carolina. He learned who they were, I guess. And, well, he had to because he called them. Told them I had a guy up there in a lot of trouble. If they wanted to do anything, they better come up. And so they did, you know, how families are. And so they came up. And it proved to be the last time they ever had to get me out of jail so far. My mother's been dead now for a number of years. It was her last one, thank God. And when she died, it was with a heart full of gratitude for a program that had given her a son for 29 years, of whom she was enormously proud. And so I'd be great. Of all the things I've got to be grateful for, that would be top of the list. So tremendously, that she came along with my sister. I didn't know how to tell them I didn't want to get out of jail, that I was afraid to get out. They got me released on bond, charged with manslaughter, and knew I would never drink. Not because I was alcoholic. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I didn't even know what an alcoholic was, but I knew whatever it wasn't me. And I just knew that I wouldn't drink. I mean, God knows, how could you possibly drink after having done something as horrible as that? The better question is, how would you not drink after committing something like that? But I had no clue about that. I just know that I got out on the 17th of July. On the 18th of July, I was as drunk as any human's ever been, and did my level best to stay that way till November the 19th of 56. And I didn't intend for that to be my last drink, but that day I knew it was going to be my last one for a long time. I was going to be tried that day. And there was no trial. I had no defense. The hell of blackouts is there's no defense. I mean, somebody tells you what you've done, you can't even argue with it. You can't even tell a version of it. There's none. And so that day came for that trial, and I finished a bottle of gin. It probably had almost as much as that bottle has. And I finished that off, went down, knew it was a one-way trip. I knew that I would not be coming back out of that court. And the prediction was true. I listened to the trial as if I were on the jury. I had to listen to the evidence just like they did. And I would have convicted me. My God, anybody would have. And when they got through, they delivered a verdict, and the judge delivered the sentence. And I was sentenced to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I'd been, as you gathered, I was not a hothouse flower, and going to jail was routine for me. I have no clue how many times I've been to jail. I like to think I've been the exact right number of times, because last one was enough so far. Maybe one more would have been too many. I like to think it was the right number. And so when that sentence was passed that day, I guess as any human being would do, I had a reaction of, an instinctive reaction of fear. And yet, at the same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was done. And the next day, I was led into the Maximum Custody Penitentiary in the state of Michigan at a place called Jackson. And the day I walked in there, I remember the day very well. It was a gray November day. When I walked in, I was absolutely convinced that it was a one-way trip, that I would never survive. And I didn't care. I just simply didn't care. It was not callousness or anything like that. I was just devastated. I just simply did not care. And it was just like checking me into a vault somewhere. And so when I walked in, I was a dead man walking, for doggone sure. Ashamed every breath that I took. And I tell you this, I was as isolated as I've greeted thousands and thousands of people in the Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never met anybody as isolated as me. It wasn't that I didn't like people, I just didn't acknowledge people. I was just sunk in like a guy in a coma. And I tell you this, it's amazing to me about most profound things are simple when you get right down to it. When I look back to what on earth could possibly change the course of a life like I've just described, and I've given you just a glimmer of the headlines of that thing, I was a bad drunk, I was a bad dude, in just any way you want to cut it. And nobody would have bet on this horse, I guarantee you that. And to find something that could take a life like that, culminated with a crime so hideous that it's not only unpunishable, it's unthinkable. And the mountain of guilt that absolutely owned me at that time. Nobody would have bet on this guy making 30 days. And I don't think I would have had things happen differently than they did. And I'll tell you what happened to turn things around for me a bit. I had a guy to interview me one day, and I'd had many, many people interview me about my life and about problems and all that kind of stuff. And this guy, when he got through talking with me, made the same astounding diagnosis that everybody had that I'd ever talked with. My God, you sure drink a lot. Or you're drunk. You're a problem drinker. You're an alcoholic. I'd heard that stuff ad nauseum, and it always went on to something like, why don't you quit drinking? Now, certainly this predated the intervention type stuff that we have today. You know, I thank God for the stuff we've got today that can a little bit more systematically deal with helping folks through crisis. But it just didn't exist back then. We had no such thing. We did have detox, but they called it jail. Had fairly effective treatment if you call getting hit upside the head with a blackjack treatment. It worked. It'll get you sober. It doesn't tend to have lasting effect, but it's certainly a short-term solution. But that's what we had. I'd never heard of treatment. I'd no such thing as getting into a hospital unless you could buy the place. And so for the average walking around alcoholic, there was nothing available. And nobody had ever suggested anything to me. Of all the people who diagnosed me, nobody had ever suggested anything that made sense, like quit drinking. And that never made sense to me somehow. It just didn't appeal. This guy who finally talked with me said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. He said, we have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go. And I'd never heard of AA. I had no clue what he was talking about. I don't think he did either. I think somebody where he went to school told him, if you get a case that thick, it's all about booze, tell him you ought to go to AA. That's exactly what he did. And you know what's amazing? That's the first invitation I ever heard, ever. And I've never looked back. Isn't that amazing? Now, certainly there was no healing influence from that. But my God, you know, what does it take to just catch a guy at the right moment and say, hey, there's a solution over here. Check it out. And that's all he was saying. And it wasn't mandated. It wasn't one of those things that we're going to put you up against the wall if you don't. None of that. Just said, there's a group you ought to go. I don't think he tried to explain what it was. And then somebody must have told me it was Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't all worked up into a frenzy about going to that. Yeah, it just doesn't sound attractive, does it? Alcoholics Anonymous, yeah, who in the world would ever aspire to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? secret drunks. Just what I've always wanted to be. God. Well, I mean, I just sort of had some mixed reactions when I started to get a little bit of information about what it was. I figured it'd be something like a tent meeting revival like we have down in the Bible Belt with shake snaking and drum beating and all kind of stuff. I knew it had to be some kind of a religious thing for sure. And so when I walked in, huge group, when I walked into my first meeting, February 2nd of 57, had no clue what to expect. I had one guy spoke to me, had 300 members in the group, and one guy spoke to me, had an officer on the door, and he read my name off my shirt, Ivan Strauss, yes, sir, and he said, sit down. And I sat down and listened to my first meeting. The first thing we did was pray. We did a serenity prayer, and that's not a long prayer, but it sounded long to me. And as soon as they started praying, I said, I knew it, my God, it got me now. And now I'm going to be here before long. I'll be taking up quarters at the airport or something. I mean, I just thought sure that I was had, you know. And I was not thrilled about that thing. And then they went through the regular meeting, read a bunch of stuff. Good God, they read everything readable. And then they introduced the speaker, and I listened to my first speaker. That guy got up and told his story. I never heard an alcoholic tell his story. I'd heard him tell stories, but not their own. But that one had to be true. Nobody gonna make that up. And I sat there and listened to that man, and it was shocked more than anything. I thought, why on earth would he do that? Why would a decent-looking guy, blue preaching suit and all that, stand up in front of 300 hair-legged convicts and bare his soul? That made no sense to me. And when I left, I was probably more confused than when I came in, but the next week I was back. And what brought me back, I hope to God I never tell about what got me started in AA without sharing this, because what brought me back was not the experience of the man, not the wisdom of the man, it was the spirit of the man. He was genuinely the most enthusiastic person I had ever met up to that time. Thank God for that. Thank God I didn't get some gloomy Gus that was just so happy he could throw up. I am so grateful that I got somebody that was alive, that knew something about sobriety and that life could be worthwhile. Thank God for that, because that's what brought me back to my second meeting. I couldn't have told anybody why I was there. Nobody cared. Nobody would have cared if I hadn't come. I just found myself sitting back there and then stayed there, never missed a single meeting. I'll stay there 3.5 years, never missed a single meeting. Whether it's once a day or once a week, never missed one. And it was a slow go for me. I tell you, I'm going to have to, Rick, my card man is getting warmed up now. But I'm going to have to go real rushing like on this thing. Just tell you this. I'm a believer that, like it says in Doc's opinion, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not just some goody thing that we get into and the fellowship will take care of it. I'm not a believer in that. I think the fellowship is a powerful thing, but it's a limited thing. Because there'll come a time when the fellowship ain't there. I'm going to be by myself. And if I don't have something more than that, I'm going to be in a world of hurt. I believe in exactly what it says in Doc's opinion there at some place. It says, it doesn't say it in these words, but for an illness as severe as ours, we have to have more than frothy emotional appeal. We have to have a solution that has depth and weight. And so true, so true. And so I got into a group that the recovery group at Jackson Prison was one of the finest AA groups I've ever been in. And I've been in some good ones, and in a good one right now. But it was absolutely no better than the one I had in a maximum custody penitentiary. I was introduced to this fellowship by people who understood the fifth tradition. They did a great job of carrying the message to new guys, and they helped me understand the design for living called Alcoholics Anonymous. They helped me understand the steps. And I'll just visit them in a word and just sort of synthesize it this way. You know, the steps to me break down into three kind of manageable compartments. The first three are basically about surrender and finding a power. They're not about recovery. They're about establishing a foundation for recovery. They're about stopping the bleeding, about giving a place so that we can hang on. I know people who have spent their entire sobriety and never gone beyond it. I've known some who've never gone that far. There's no criteria by success or failure as long as you're on your feet and standing and not drinking. That, you know, there's nobody going to say that you're not shaping up to standards, any of that stuff. So there's no. The way I look at it, we stop at whatever place we're willing to settle for. I'm not somebody who could stand. I could not get by on the first three steps. That's not enough for me. I'm an aggravated case. I'm more miserable dry than I am drinking because I'm more sensitive to what's going on in my life. And so it wouldn't be a good place for me. I'm somebody who believes that alcoholism is far more complex than drinking. There's a lot more to not drinking than not drinking. And so what those first three steps for me is gives me safe harbor so I can hang on and then go to work. Next four are basically sort of like, okay, you got it, what is it? It's kind of taking a look at causes and conditions, of searching down and coming to grips with who I really am. With what am I talking about when I say I'm an alcoholic? Am I saying I'm just somebody who drinks too much? No. It is a more complex thing. Trying to understand what it is that makes my canoe travel so funny. And so what that four-step does is gives me a handle on who I am and what I'm about. I start to get a look at defects of characters, those things that propel and drive me in strange directions. And so a very important place for that, of opening up to another human being. The person I took my fifth step with was the first human being on this planet to ever get a look at me. He knew me better than my mother knew me. Tremendously important thing to break up a life made up of self-centered isolation, eh? And what that did was crack the wall just a bit. What a tremendously important thing. Six and seven are the other side of that. Okay, you've seen it. Here's what it is. Here's what it looks like. Here's what throws you out of shape. You want to do something about it or don't you? Well, if you do, then six and seven are the ticket. We become willing to have God remove all these defects of character. Do I really want to get well? Do I really want to become a different kind of guy than I am? Do I want to get rid of this junk that's been eating my lunch for years, or don't I? And if I am I willing to take a stand? And if so, I mean, you could talk about that all day. You know, I'll just say it this way. In all these years in AA, I have never consciously solved one single problem in this program. Not one. It doesn't work that way. It is a process of recovery. And what happens is that as I grow in this program, I don't solve problems. Problems disappear. As I develop new characteristics, new abilities, new values, for lo and behold, one day I look around and I ain't mad at nobody. I'm not lying nearly as much. You know, things are starting to change. It's a gradual process. And then the last five, which is really doing them a disservice, are the steps of restoration. They're the things that will help me. I had the great fortune, one of the few things valuable about being old, is that I had the great privilege of meeting our founder, Bill. And I sat in a meeting with him one day. He was talking about anonymity, talking about traditions, and he said something about the outcome of the steps. He said, he was talking about anonymity. He said, AA was never intended to be a furtive hiding place for alcoholics. It's not some place where we get into some little glass prison, don't tell nobody. That's not what it's about. The outcome of AA, if I practice these principles, is to restore me to my rightful place in this world. I can take my place there. I don't have to apologize to anybody for anything. It will liberate me and make me free. And it doesn't happen just by staying sober. What it happens from is by those steps of restoration, where I search out those things that I've carried around as a load of guilt for years. And what it says is to go back and make right those wrongs. And as I do that, it'll make me free. And it'll give me a very, very reliable pathway which I can travel to be a free man to take my place in this world. And I'm here to tell you that's true. Today, there's no place on this earth that I know of that I can't go and look any human that I meet in the eye. That's freedom, folks. That's freedom. I'm a free man. And I'm free because I've gotten those things done, and it gave me and then the rest of it, what I'm going to be dealing with down here this weekend, is about those steps that put us into to real momentum in life, that really make things happen. And so wonderful stuff happens as a result of those steps. And I'm sorry to slide by him so quick, but he's a cruel man. He throws stuff. I just tell you this. One of my guys reminded me of before the meeting. I just tell you this. It's amazing what happens. It's amazing what happens. I'm a guy who believes in miracles. But I've got a very practical, very pragmatic definition of miracles. In my mind, miracles are what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. Amazing things happen. Things happen beyond my imagination. And when I finally got out of prison, I'll just tell you this in a rushing hurry if he doesn't throw at me. When I walked out of prison, I was like any fellow walking out of there. I guess I might have had a little deeper passion about freedom than many I've known. But I knew the day I walked out, I promised myself, I didn't announce it to anybody, I promised myself at the depth of my soul I would never go through that indignity again. And what I meant was that I would do whatever it took. I didn't care what that was. I mean that just as seriously today as I meant it then. And so it was a hard-nosed commitment, not a kind of a hope things work out. Forget that. This was a do-or-die commitment. I knew AA was my lifeline. I was like most guys. I wanted to get a place in life. I didn't want anything jazzy. I didn't want to be sitting in a big swanky hotel in Las Vegas overlooking the world. I didn't want that. I wanted to be a citizen. For once in my life, I'd never been a citizen. I'd never voted, never paid taxes. Nothing that citizens do. I wanted to be a citizen. I wanted to be a friend. Wanted to have somebody trust me. I didn't know if I ever would. Wanted that. I wanted to have a job and make a living without hustling and conniving and taking advantage of somebody. Simple things, eh? Things that most of us just take for granted. Well, I'm here to tell you those and many more little dreams have come true, God knows, in spades. I've been restored to a place of useful service in this world. And it's amazing. I've had things happen that still defy my imagination, and they're so old, they're almost in history books now. But I still find it hard sometimes to believe. 2 weeks after I was out, I was visiting a prison as an outsider. Tom and I are going tomorrow to a prison. I was visiting a prison 2 weeks after I was out of maximum custody. 2 months after I was out, I was the outside sponsor of a prison group, a position of honor and trust. My God, I could not have been more thrilled if I'd been elected governor. That really meant something to a guy like me to be able to be a trusted servant, being of service in the place where I had just lost my life. Unbelievable. Same time, 2 months out, my parole guy came to me and said you could do better if you were driving. And I said, yeah, but I can't. Sure enough, I was driving just a few weeks later. For obvious reasons, I was never supposed to operate a motor vehicle for the rest of my life. I firmly believe, and I don't believe, I firmly know that when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. Now, I'm not saying when I want to drive, the walls come down. When God's got work for me to do, the walls come down. Same guy who wondered if he'd ever have a friend. I was elected DCM. I wasn't even running. I'd done 2 years at Michigan State while I was locked up. So I had learned to spell DCM. I couldn't spell the words, but I knew DCM. And I was elected DCM. Same guy who wondered if he'd ever have a friend. I'm asked to be the trusted servant for my AA folks in 15 cities. Something else. Sitting home one day, 2 years after I was out, got a phone call from the headquarters of the prison system. Guy on the phone that I'd met him once. He visited where I was sponsoring the AA group. And I knew his name, and we chatted for about 2 or 3 minutes, that's all. And it was him on the phone. He said, Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. Now, clearly it's understandable. First thing I said was, do you know who you're talking to? And he said, yes, yes, we do. We've checked you out. And of course they had. And I said to him, intellectually, my God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. I never thought, nobody else had ever thought of it. The day of that phone call, now here it is. The day of that phone call, there had never been an ex-con in the history of this world hired into a prison system. I knew they weren't going to start with me. But if they're going to do it, they got to start with somebody. And so I said to the man, rather do it than anything. To myself, I said, there ain't no way. But when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I was employed as a rehabilitation officer in the prison system of North Carolina, and I functioned there as a professional employee for 39 years. I wound up being the oldest rat in that barn, too. I didn't mean to stay that long, but I was interested in what I was doing and had a phenomenal career. I wouldn't have traded with Bill Gates. I didn't make quite as much money, but I literally would not have traded with Bill Gates or anybody else. I had a wonderful, can you imagine an opportunity to go back and be a leader to make changes in a world that you'd invested part of your life in? Can you imagine that? Now, I'm not a professional ex-convict. I don't know of any market for professional ex-convicts. I'm a correctional professional. Not now. I'm unemployed right now. But I used to be a professional, a correction professional. I finished my education in correctional administration. And it wasn't because I was ambitious. My career skyrocketed right from the beginning. I just got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I got educated just so I could use as big words as they did, I guess, or write better papers or something. Anyway, I didn't need it, except for just my sense of well-being. And so it was a marvelous, marvelous career that I wouldn't have traded for anything. And the day I retired, folks in AA, word gets around. To be an anonymous program, I bet stuff that happens in Vegas gets around. But to be an anonymous program, it's amazing how the word gets around. And word got out. I let it get out about a year before I retired that I was getting ready to hang it up. And folks in AA came to me and said, Tom, we need some leadership in what we're trying to do in corrections. Will you chair the effort for our state? And I'm just finishing a 39-year high-pressure career. And like any human, I thought maybe I ought to take a break. But it didn't. And I'll tell you what, now it doesn't take long. We ponder decisions. It doesn't take long to make a decision. What takes a long time is the indecision that precedes it. And so it took me about 30 seconds to make a heavyweight determination. I thought about it. Yeah, sure, I wouldn't mind taking a break. But then I thought, if there's anybody in this country that understands the dilemma of an alcoholic in prison, buddy, it's got to be you. I've been studying it all my life. For God's sakes, if I don't know it, I'm dumber than a post. And if there's anybody that has access to the system, it's me. I felt like I'd hired about half the people that worked there. And so I had access, like second to none. My belief is, you take it whatever it's worth, my belief is, if I can take a look at a need like that, that I am perfectly capable of making a contribution, and I selfishly turn and walk away, I pay a price for that. I pay a price for that. I don't believe I would be the guy that you'd want to be speaking to this group tonight or going to that prison tomorrow or going to Whiskey Pete's this weekend. Don't believe I'd be the guy. If I can't get past that, and when I see the opportunity to serve, that I'm willing to step forward. And so I warned my wife. I lied to her a little bit. She thought I was going to retire, sit around, and do honeydews. And I tell this on her. One day she got a little romantic. And I don't know. I'm not going to get X-rated here. But one day we were having lunch, and that was a real novelty at our house. And she looked over at me kind of dreamy-eyed and said, we're having lunch together. I said, do you want to get some matching clothes and go walk around the mall? She said, go to hell. The romance was over. But I told her, I said, I decided to take that job. I said, fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a busy couple of years. And I don't know how many years ago that's been, three or four, something like that. And tell her that it'll get better, will you? I hate to be the only one lying to her. But it's been a marvelous kind of a thing, and it has been enormously rewarding to be able to get some stuff done in that state. I guess what I'm saying, folks, and to those of you who are new, for God's sakes, don't sell yourself short. What this program is about, we're not interested in cloning soldiers for the AA Army. That's not what we're about. What our function is here is to help folks get to their maximum potential, whatever that is. It's not to be another Tom I or a Tom S or any of that. And that's what we want to do. If you're somebody who's broken and beaten up by this thing and you've run out of hope, I want you to know that there's hope here. You're in a place where where hope lives. And for God's sakes, man, don't pass this up as just some casual kind of an acquaintance. Take a look at it as something that can be a transforming life experience. The day I walked in here was among the darkest days of my life. When I thought of my future, it looked like a dark tunnel. I'm here to tell you that there are few people on this planet any freer than me, any happier than me, or who've been more richly rewarded than me. I'm a guy who's been blessed beyond imagination. And I'm just delighted to see you guys. Take care. Yeah.